to have some insight into themselves. They want to have some relief from the various stresses and struggles of their life. So when people come to a spiritual practice, they often come with wanting something. And Buddhist spirituality, the Buddhist practice, in reflecting on this, encourages us to look at the wanting, maybe more than what we're hoping, what we want to get. And that seems to be a little bit odd for some people because, you know, we want our peace, we want our well-being, we want to develop compassion, we want all these wonderful things and ideals. And Buddhism says that maybe you need to spend some serious time looking at the nature of the wanting itself. Because the wanting itself can get in the way of what you want. The image I have is the clown, maybe in the ice capades, on ice or something. The clown who wants to pick up a ball on the ground. And every time the clown steps forward to pick it up, he or she kicks it forward a little bit. And then goes forward to kind of grab the ball again, then kicks it forward a little bit. When we're in the grips of wanting, sometimes the wanting gets in the way of the very thing we want to get, especially in spiritual circles, spiritual practices. So Buddhist practice emphasizes the importance of looking at desire. And as a kind of at this point, I might be useful to mention that in the overall scheme of Buddhist spirituality, there's homework for you to do, or there's work to be done. Sometimes people come to meditation and just want something that is a relief from all the doing and all the wanting and relief from all the they just want to have kind of quiet, peaceful mind, and the quiet, peaceful mind, I think, is the only thing that they really want their Buddhist spirituality to involve. But Buddhist practice also involves doing some homework or doing some explorations, some investigation. And one of the things that we're encouraged to investigate is the nature of desire, of wanting. And to make it a theme for exploring, get to know it better. And not just simply to rely on sometimes a soothing experience of meditation or a quiet experience of meditation, but to actually maybe use whatever calm you have in meditation to explore what your desires are about, the nature of them, the wanting. So that's kind of bad news for some people. They don't want to have a spiritual practice involves any work. But it actually is the case. It's very useful. It's very important to get to know your desires. So desires and wanting are a huge part of any life, not just a spiritual life. And so aside from wanting peace and all the nice spiritual things people might want, they, there's no shortage of things we might want, right? I mean, it seems like there's new wants being discovered and invented and created and added to the billboards every day. And probably the number of things human beings could want, if you plot it historically, probably, you know, it's one of these exponential curves. You know, in the 20th century, it's gone up, you know, 100-fold, the number of things we could want. And now we're in the 21st century, right? Well, almost. Where are we? And you know, is it gonna plateau out soon enough, or are we just gonna continue creating more and more wonderful things to want? One of the great discoveries of the 20th century, you might not think it's great, but one of the very significant discoveries of the 20th century was the tremendous power of advertisement in creating wants. I think it was sometime in I'm not so sure of the history of this, maybe some of you know it better, but somewhere around the 1920s, 1930s, American industry realized that if they're going to have this mass production, assembly line production, a mass production of goods, they had to have a market for it. And how are they going to create a market? And so they started dreaming up creative ways of getting people to want things they didn't realize that they needed or wanted until then. And there was one story I read, I don't remember it so well, of they wanted to sell, a suitcase manufacturer discovered a wonderful way of making suitcases, you know, mass producing them. but they needed a mass market for suitcases. So they somehow got into the advertisements this idea that when you send a college student to college, which was becoming popular back then, they have to have all these things with them, which no one knew they had to have with them then. But they had to have all these clothes and, you know, towels and sheets and all this stuff. But the under message, kind of the underlying message was, well, you have to have a suitcase to put it all in. So they encouraged people to send their college students off to college with all the stuff. And by the way, we have the suitcases just to carry the stuff with. And so the market for suitcases apparently in the mid-1920s skyrocketed. People managed fine with a lot fewer suitcases before then. I don't know if that's a good example, but one of the significant discoveries of the 20th century was the tremendous power advertisement has on the nature of our desires. That human beings, none of you, of course, I'm sure none of you are susceptible to these things. You're independent, autonomous individuals who make your own decisions and are clear about your decisions and what your wants are and what your needs are and all that. But the mass population has a phenomenal amount of very gullible people. A phenomenal number of people who will not think they need anything because they never even heard about it. And then they hear about it and then they need it, aside from wanting it. So we have a society, I think. It's called a consumer society. And a consumer society is one that one of the foundations of a consumer society is desire. If everyone's desire dropped away, there would be very little need for consumption, the kind of mass consumption that we have in our society. So desire is a very important thing, not only for Buddhist practice to explore, but it's also a very important issue for our society, our modern Western culture. And it's because it's such an important underpinning of our culture, and because so many people are driven by desire, of wanting things, people have somewhat complicated relationships to the topic of desire. It can be very threatening to people to suggest any kind of way that there's a problem with their desires. And then we have people who say, well, I deserve what I want. Or we have people who say that, it's a God-given right to my desires. Or there's all kinds of manifestos or belief systems we have in relationship to our desires that almost sometimes are resistance or protection from us looking at it very honestly, the nature of our desires. Now, what Buddhism says is that a particular kind of desire causes our stress. The Buddha never heard of environmental stress back in his time. So the Buddha attributed all stress to a particular kind of desire, desire which has gripped the mind. When the mind is gripped by desire, that's the source of stress. And sometimes in Buddhist circles we call this a wanting mind. And this is a very important distinction between having a want and having a wanting mind. And the distinction is a want can just kind of be a bubble in the mind, a desire that arises, or it'd be a nice thing to have something. And a wanting mind is a mind that's been gripped by that idea and has a certain kind of, is being propelled by that idea or is contracted around that idea. And the movement of the mind to contract around something, the movement of the mind to ingest the desire, to ingest the idea, and become a wanting mind, Buddhism says, is a fundamental source of your stress. Now, I'm not saying this in order for you to believe it or agree with me. I'm saying this to emphasize that maybe there's real value in studying your desires and getting to know it better. Maybe you don't go as far as the Buddha did and say that all your stress is founded in desire, in gripped desire. But it's very useful to look at desire. There's some very well-known aspects of desire, how it functions. One of them is that sometimes desire can grip the mind so strongly that it doesn't matter what desire is fulfilled. As soon as it's fulfilled, the momentum of wanting is still there, and you just want something else, the next thing. And this is a quite common phenomenon you see in children. You know, you give them what they want, and, you know, thank you, and then 30 seconds later they want something else, the next thing, the next thing. I was really amazed by my son when he was a year and a half. He would want without even knowing what was there. He'd be gripped by desire, and he would just... I knew this because he would take his hand back and grab what was behind him. He had no idea what was behind him. He just wanted it. So it starts early. And I know he suffered a lot because of his desires. And maybe his parents more. But one of the aspects of the wanting mind, not of wanting itself. Wanting itself can be neutral, just, you know, having a desire. Haven't you ever had a desire that just kind of floated through and floated out and easy come, easy go? I hope you've had. If you haven't, you better start meditating. But the wanting mind, it can be insatiable. And it can be invisible, the insatiability of the mind. It can feel so compelling, I want, I want, I want. And there can be a kind of wanting can have such a compelling feeling that, compelling is the word, right? It feels like it's true. It feels like it's the right thing. It feels like the necessary thing. It feels like the absolute thing that has to happen right now. And then we add a whole, we can build a whole philosophy to support this particular compulsion. That's why we need to be a little bit careful about the mind state a person's in when they invent their philosophy. Philosophies are often not neutral. But you shouldn't talk philosophy with someone who's angry, and you shouldn't talk philosophy with someone who's gripped with desire. It's not a good idea. Just, you know, check in. If you're going to talk philosophy, find out if they're, you know, cool a little bit. So, I lost track of what I was saying by my little aside. What was I saying? No one else knows either? Be cool. Gripped by desire. Yeah, we'll jump in. What? I know that. That much I know. The train of the discussion. I just jump in someplace. Doesn't matter, maybe, where we pick up.
So how it's different from just having a want that doesn't...
Right. I'm not sure what I was saying there either, but it's very important to see the difference between just to have a want that arises and passes and mind being gripped by it. One of the things I encourage you to do, I just did the other day, is to look for an opportunity when you're gripped by a desire and take it, here I can fulfill my homework assignment, my Buddhist homework assignment. And investigate that desire. So I'm going to find out something about this desire. And there's a number of things you can explore about it, but one of the most fascinating things to explore is what I call writing out the desire. Which means, notice, the stronger the compulsion, the more instructive this exercise is. So really choose a good one. You know, wait for the really powerful compulsion. And then just sit still and quiet. And don't act on the compulsion, on the desire. And just sit there and feel what that compulsion feels like in your body, in your mind. Feel what happens to your thoughts. Feel the various justification the mind makes about why this is not the time to do this experiment. You know, the mind is very clever. And feel the sense of pressure in the body, in the arms or the legs or wherever it's felt. And feel it and feel it and feel it. But don't move. Be committed to just hanging out there, not moving, just feeling. Just feeling, feeling, feeling. And what you'll find is that it'll get probably... It might get stronger and stronger and stronger, more and more compelling. And then it'll break like a crest of a wave. And then it'll just settle away and it'll disappear. And in the midst of it feeling so compelling, you can never imagine that you could do without it. But 2 minutes later, after it's broken, the wave is broken and subsided, you wonder, what was the big deal? So I call that riding out the desire. You know, if you like to surf or live dangerously, you know, this is a good thing to do, this exercise. Hang out there and feel it. It'll give you a lot of power over your desires. It'll help you decide who's in charge. Are you in charge or are your desires in charge? And I hope that you're in charge rather than your desires. It'll also teach you that the sense of compulsion doesn't have to be followed through on. The sense that this is the right thing and needs to happen right now is maybe a little sometimes an illusion that our desires kind of sprinkle into our mind. And we don't have to believe our desires so much anymore. I've heard a number of times people say that they finally gave up smoking or gave up drinking, alcohol or coffee or whatever. When they found themselves at 11 o'clock at night or in the middle of the night or something, getting in their car and driving across town and finding a store that's open and not finding a store that's open, finally finding one that's open and rushing in and getting that ice cream or just because, you know, and they're standing there in the aisles with the ice cream or the coffee or the cigarettes or whatever. Who's in charge here? What's going on here? And they said, "This, I don't want to live this way." And so some people I know have actually stopped, you know, in the aisles of, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. They say, "Okay, enough." The power of desire, the wanting mind. So what is it that translates a simple want? What transforms a simple want into a wanting mind? What causes the mind to be gripped by that? And that's an interesting study also. So this is not something for me to... This is something for you to discover for yourself, because it's going to be individual for each of you. But there's all kinds of things that can help transform a simple desire into a wanting mind, a gripped mind. One of the things which, I don't know how common it is, but one that comes to mind right first is fear. Fear of not getting enough, fear of being left behind, fear of not doing it right according to everyone else, fear of... I know one person who doesn't have a computer. Can you imagine? The person raised their hand once in a room this maybe this size and said, "You know, how many of you have a computer or who doesn't have a computer?" And he raised his hand, and he felt embarrassed. You know, but you know, everyone else has computers, and I don't have a computer. I mean, maybe I should want to have a computer. Maybe having that's a good want to have. Maybe now I want it because I don't want to be left behind. I don't want to be embarrassed. I don't want to feel like the old fogey. Who Rip Van Winkle kind of person. So fear in many forms of fear can affect how we latch on to our desires. There's also all kinds of beliefs we might have around desire. One of the common beliefs that that is often reported about, often talked about in Dharma talks, is the belief that the fulfillment of a desire, fulfillment of desires, is going to bring us lasting happiness or lasting security or lasting well-being or lasting whatever. And I don't think the mind operates so consciously at this level, but sometimes in a more unconscious level, it can be, "Oh, if I only have that, if I only have that, if I only have that, then everything will be okay. If I only can find the proper spouse, the person who can be my life mate, then..." So then you find that person and you get married. And then you wake up the next morning and the person farts a lot. farts a lot, you know, or you know, suddenly you're like, wait a minute. I mean, I've known lots of people, you know, who have married someone, thought it was going to be like happy ever after, and discovered that it wasn't. So this we set ourselves up sometimes for suffering, but we put a lot of expectation in what our desires will fulfill. And they're gonna, and they can, we expect them to fulfill a lot more than they actually can do. Some desires, all they are, you know, some desires, all they can do is provide temporary pleasure. But, you know, if we're lonely and we go to the refrigerator for ice cream, if someone asks you why you're eating ice cream, then you might say, well, because I like the flavor. I just felt it was nice to have something sweet after that dinner I had or whatever. But maybe more on a subconscious level, it's kind of this compulsion to try in some way to feel something uncomfortable inside of us, some uncomfortable feeling of loneliness or being alone. And it's that desire to fill that which causes us to grip onto the desire for ice cream. And it's a misplaced attempt to fill that hole. And we certainly get pleasure from the ice cream, and some kind of physical pleasure can be soothing for a little while, but it doesn't really fill that hole of loneliness. So what is it that makes your desires, your simple desires? I would suggest, as a working hypothesis, that you take the idea that all desires begin as just a simple bubble of an idea in the mind. They're completely neutral. They have no power to them in and of themselves. A desire in and of itself has no power. But you give the power to a desire by the way that your mind grips onto it. And what is it? How do you grip onto it? What are you trying to do with it? So some people might complain and say, well, this sounds too nihilistic. You know, I'm not supposed to have any desires at all. Not act on any desires. It's possible to act on desires independent of the mind being gripped by the desire. You can have a desire, and you can see, oh, you can kind of evaluate. Is this useful right now? Do I need this? Is this conducive to my further well-being or the well-being of others? Or, you know, is this something that really seems appropriate for me in my life right now? And do I need it to create some balance in my life? Do I need it to do something that's useful? Or am I gripped by desire? Am I gripped by compulsion that it has to happen? I think that it's possible to have wisdom be the hand that picks up the desire so we act on it. And part of the function of mindfulness practice is to give wisdom a chance to function more. The wisdom can't function when the mind is gripped by desire. So can we discover a mind which is not gripped by desire? And this is, for some people, a huge task, because desire, say it this way, that the wanting mind works very subtly, and it's self-creating, so that it actually can be chugging along inside of us, constantly recreating itself, so much so that it almost feels like it's who we are. And people get very frightened by the idea of giving up that wanting mind, because they'll feel disoriented. Who am I in the world if I'm not that wanting mind? And it's not a matter of, you know, just wanting ice cream or coffee or, you know, bigger cars or bigger homes or, you know, spouses or whatever. It can be, those are kind of superficial. The kind of deeper, kind of subtle cycles of desires have to do with creating a self, making a self, making yourself into the kind of self you want to show the world, which we do constantly in the choices of what we say and how we speak and the clothes we wear. in what the kind of activities we do. There's a tremendous amount of self-making going on in this world. And again, the advertisers know this really well. Because why would they sell motor oil showing some woman, you know, in the peak of health and physical fitness and with big boobs, and some guy that's kissing her? Why? What does that have to do with motor oil? Well, because I think they know that if you think that the motor oil relates to having that wonderful, glamorous life, then you want to be like, you want to create a self that's kind of similar. And maybe something about motor oil will make you be a person like that too. So let's get that particular brand, not just any motor oil, but that particular brand is going to do it. So desire. So desire also is a form. One of the reasons desire is a source of stress is that desire can set up frustration and disappointment. We can be frustrated when our desires are not fulfilled, and we can be disappointed sometimes when they are, because sometimes things don't live up to the high standard, high expectation we have for them. But in the teachings of the Buddha, the reason desire, the wanting mind, is the foundation for stress is not because of disappointment and frustration, but because the wanting mind itself is suffering. The wanting mind itself is a tightening of the mind around this simple desire. And then the sad thing is that tightening of the mind around desire, that itself is uncomfortable. It's suffering. And then we have our favorite strategies about how to get rid of that discomfort. And one strategy for getting rid of discomfort is to want more. And then we become like the clown that's constantly kicking the ball forward. When the desire has been locked in place as a wanting desire, we're uncomfortable. We're uncomfortable. One strategy some people have is to want more. And it can become a never-ending cycle of wanting and wanting and wanting, trying to fix the very thing, trying to fix the very problem by making the problem over again, recreating the problem. So Buddhist practice teaches, Buddhist teachings say, that it's possible to have a mind which is not gripped by desire. It's possible to have a mind which is at peace. Possible to have a mind which doesn't have any grip to it at all. Kind of an open mind. I think it's a nice expression. Buddhists are into creating, having open minds. Ungripped minds, unclosed minds. And there's two basic ways of finding your way to a peaceful mind, to an open mind, mind ungripped by desire. One is to let go into the peaceful mind, to have some sense. Maybe some of you have some sense from some experience, or have some sense, immediate sense of the peacefulness that lies right there waiting for you. And sometimes you can kind of move into it. But moving into it requires that you value that kind of experience. And all of you probably say you value a peaceful mind. But I think that it's so easy to get caught up in our daily life and have so many different wants that the peaceful mind doesn't seem to kind of fit into our busy life and all the things we want to do. And so we lose track that it's really valuable to have a peaceful mind. So one way of developing a peaceful mind is just to move into it, to find it, to have some sense of it and kind of let go into it. The other way has to do with really taking an honest assessment of our desires themselves. And to really study the desires, get to know them really well and respectfully. Not with aversion, not with judgment, not to self-criticism that I have a desire, but with kind of a joy. Oh, I'm going to get to know this desire really, really well. Here's a chance for me to understand something about myself. Because Buddhist spirituality focuses a lot on, let me understand something about myself. Because if you choose peace without understanding, then it's all too easy for you to recreate the conditions that cause anxiety. But if you understand what causes anxiety, if you understand your anxiety really well, then you can see the anxiety coming and you can let go of it earlier, not just simply not do the things that cause it. So there's a kind of, it's possible to actually have joy in the very things that cause you difficulty because you realize they're going to help you. Understanding it is really important. They're going to help you in the long term. So then we use mindfulness to turn our attention towards our desires when we're gripped by them and really begin exploring them from all the different angles and as creatively as we can with all the intelligence we have available to us, as if we're a naturalist, as if we're this great, you know, scientist of the mind, and we're going to discover something that no one's ever discovered about how the mind works. I'm just going to just use your creativity, your imagination, use your intelligence to study and discover and understand your desire. And the more you understand and see your desire, the easier it'll be to let go of it. And let go of it. As we do this kind of exploration, this homework on desire and study it and get to know it, it's very useful to remember that one of the very important supports for Buddhist practice, for this kind of exploration, is a sense of compassion. And in this case, if you're studying your own desire, it's self-compassion. Is to do all this with a tremendous sense of self-compassion, compassion for yourself, loving kindness for yourself. Not to do it with a sense that you're bad or wrong. Not to do it with a sense that, of high expectations of success at something. But to do it as, you know, you're a human being who's trying to, you know, just like any other human being, is doing the best you can. I'm convinced every human being is doing the best they can. I really think that. And in doing the best you can, you know, you're struggling and. You've come across a particular struggle that you have, and now you're going to investigate it with as much compassion as you can. So that's my thoughts for today. That's what I want to talk about.
Maybe help with some practical things with this. Suppose I'm having a conversation with someone, and I have a desire to explain to them my point of view, or what is right or what is wrong, which is arbitrary designation. But trying to convey this, but now that I know that I have a desire, that I can then sit there and say, okay, I want to ride out this wave of desire. Meanwhile, this other person is staying there looking at silence.
You have to do this exercise with some common sense, and then choose your battles well. I mean, appropriately. If someone's waiting for you to answer some question they have, I mean, it's kind of impolite to just say, "Well, you know, forget you. I'm going to do my exercise here." But you know, look for another opportunity. I'm sure there'll be others. Maybe something that's more private or personal. You know, just you in the refrigerator or something.
But you do get caught in that.
Oh, but this is like, but yeah. Oh no. The refrigerator is a real life thing. but in terms of talking to people, I've actually had a lot of good time, painful time both, doing this not one on one with people so much. Actually, there also. In conversations, yes, but I was thinking now in meetings, where there's lots of people to fill in the empty space. And I have a lot of things I want to say. I went to a lot of meetings in my time in living in Buddhist centers. And because of my particular problems of my mind, the meetings were among the most painful experiences I ever had in Buddhist circles in America. And part of it was this compulsion to kind of get my way or say my thing or everything. So it became a very powerful place for me to explore this compulsion and ride it out. And because I didn't need to say it right away. I could easily wait 5 minutes and then interrupt or, you know, wait my turn or whatever. So that was actually a very important place. And I actually became a more skillful speaker, usually, if I remember this, at meetings, if I don't speak when the compulsion is there, but listen to the desire that's behind the compulsion, listen to the wisdom or the foolishness that's there, and then, you know, wait a little bit, and then when the time seems open, then to speak. And I do this one-on-one with people actually all the time, because I find myself often wanting to respond and say something while the person is still speaking. So it's not a matter of filling the silence. Sometimes people speak a lot. So there's lots of opportunity to sit there and watch myself and my compulsion to interrupt. Is that real life enough? Yes?
Last week, when you were talking about communication or, you know, the speaking compassionately and taking care of that, I found a desire in a backwards way, which is when you were talking about trying to speak to someone and have them keep turning away from you.
Yes.
And I had this immediate, clear insight into a frustration and a real kind of difficulty I was having with someone in my life, and realizing that I wanted them to talk to me directly or straight, or have this kind of, I had this idea of connection. I wanted this connection. And so it was really easy for me then to say, oh, I want that, and I'm not getting it, and I'm frustrated, and I'm unhappy, because I want that. And I was just really able to say, oh, well, you know, there, I want that, and that's interesting that I want that.
Were you in some sense less frustrated because of seeing all of it?
Oh, completely. I was absolutely, it was such a, it was really amazing. This has been going on for, you know, a while. Uh-huh. But I was just thinking that for me, as you were talking, that probably one of the difficulties I have, I mean, I want a lot of things, but I also want experiences to go a certain way. You know, I have expectations and desires around interactions and communications, and that isn't always so apparent. I mean, you want ice cream, you know, what's under that?
Right, right.
That. You know, so it was just interesting finding that desire through a back door, you know.
It prompts me to say that in the teachings of the Buddha, he understood stress to be caused by the wanting mind. So you can either study desire, or you could study stress. So when you have stress in your life, study it, get to know it, and then see what is the desire that underlies it. So in your situation, you were experiencing stress in those conversations. You knew you knew there was stress, but you didn't have a clue about your desire. But if someone had told you beforehand, there's a desire behind that stress of yours, then maybe you could have found it on your own. Mm-hmm. So am I making some sense? Mm-hmm. So you can use your stress as a cue. Whenever you feel stress, use it as a cue to see, is there a desire operating here that I'm not aware of? This is a very challenging thing to do, because some of the very subtle desires that are actually sources of some more powerful sufferings in our life are far from obvious. That's why the mind needs to get really subtle in meditation to see the subtlety of how these things work. Yes?
I wonder if the desire is for a peaceful mind.
Oh.
I don't
want to let that go. Yeah. No. So, again, you have to remember, desire itself is not a problem. It's a gripped desire which is a problem. Right? It's the when the mind is it gets tight around the desire and demanding around it. That's the problem. So you could suffer a lot wanting a peaceful mind. It could be a source of tremendous distress, but it doesn't have to be. You don't have to. That's only if you get gripped around it. I've known people who had suffered a lot because of their peacefulness. They've had some wonderful peaceful experience in meditation or somewhere in their life, and they spent years trying to get it again. I gotta have it. You know, where is it? You know, and it's just, they're just miserable. And all I had to do was, you know, stop the quest. but desire for peace, or the desire to end conflict and stress, is one, it can be one of the beautiful and essential desires that human beings have. We just have to be wise about how we hold that desire and how we follow through on it. So this is I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a very common, persistent misunderstanding about Buddhism, that Buddhism somehow is a critique of all desire. It's a critique of a particular kind of desire, which is I'm calling tonight a gripped desire. Yes.
You started tonight by talking about like the spiritual search.
Yes.
Is from a Buddhist perspective, is there anything to be sought, or is there really nothing to search for?
It's a little bit awkward, but to say it's not exactly accurate for. But there is something to search for, and that is, it's not a thing. That's why it's difficult to talk about. But the ultimate experience of a mind which is totally released from all its stress is the unconditioned, or maybe a better word is the unfabricated mind. The mind which is not in the grips of anything at all. The mind's not. The Buddhists understand that that the mind is a process, it's not a thing. And so as a process, it's constantly being constructed and fabricated. And so it's not like you have a mind and then you add wanting to it. The mind and the wanting makes the mind. That moment when the wanting is there, the wanting mind has been born. So it's a constructed, it's a fabricated mind. There is a possibility of an awareness which is not fabricated. And that would be the equivalent of, somewhat, very, very vaguely, the equivalent for Buddhists, for Christians, of maybe, you know, union with God or finding God or, something like that. So there is something that is posited that we could, that can be attained that way. Then answer your question. So sometimes it's called the deathless, the unconditioned, nirvana, nibbana, the unfabricated. Yes?
In the condition mentioned earlier about someone turning away from you when you want them to face you, you can recognize that that is a stress and frustration, and go back and say your desire is that you want them to turn toward you, but if you never tell them, it seems that that condition with that particular person will go on forever.
Oh, yes. Again, this is a very good point. There certainly is a very important place in our life for telling people things and, communication and all that. And if we're feeling some discomfort, and if you have a relationship that allows for that kind of communication, to tell that to the person, so there's, everyone understands and participates in the decision making. However, the source of the person who's uncomfortable because they're always being turned away from, the discomfort is not caused by the person turning away.
It's caused by the desire that he not.
In the receiver and listener. So even though if a person never finally stops turning away, the person always turns away. The person who realizes, the listener could actually be at peace, doesn't have to be agitated or troubled by it anymore, right? So it's still an unfortunate situation that maybe requires some communication, but the listener doesn't have to suffer because of it, because the suffering in the listener is born in the listener's mind, and is created in the listener's mind based on the conditions outside.
I can certainly see that, and you know, particularly if this isn't a person that's vitally essential to yourself, why it's okay, you can just let it go as a desire that, you know, that doesn't really upset you all that much. But if it's someone close to you, I think it would be upsetting unless you told them or tried to get them.
Well, this is where if someone very important for you, then the desire, the attachment, or the desire, or the place in which that's causing you suffering, is probably not just simply connected to the particular event of the person turning away, but it's connected to something by the nature of the relationships as a whole. So in order to understand your suffering, you have to look at wider issues and wider issues of desire, of wanting, of and how they function in there. Let's spend a few minutes quietly. And as a segue into the few minutes of quiet meditation, spend a few moments imagining or remembering what it would be like to have a mind which is completely free of wanting.